Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and earned a PhD in mechanical engineering from Michigan State University. He was a truck driver, a researcher for NASA, engineering a plan to put a man on Mars, and a university professor. At the suggestion of a friend, he got into the art auction business, and in 1969 he founded Park West Gallery, which today is the largest art dealer in the world. His name? Albert Scaglione. And I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with Albert Scaglione, who founded Park West Gallery in 1969, and today it's the largest art dealer in the world. Albert, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Nice to be here, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Sure. Well, my father and mother, Joseph and Agnes, were both Italian-Americans who had immigrant parents who actually didn't speak any much English. Both grandmothers, I never met my grandfathers because they were gone before I was born, but my grandmothers didn't speak much English but didn't have much trouble talking to me. Somehow we communicated. My dad was a truck driver. My mother went to Coleman's Business College, which was a two-year business college in Newark, which was very unusual for immigrant families to put a girl through college like that, and was a pretty high-level administrative-type person in her brother's business. They were a marble operation where they did the marble construction on things like the Americana Hospital, the Americana Hotel, the Harlem Hospital, the Lincoln Center. And this was back in the 1910s and 20s, so 1930s when they were operative. So my mom was effectively an administrative assistant, bookkeeper, accountant kind of person. And my father, she handled the books for his business. He had a trucking business and operated a couple of trucks. And that's what they did.
What did you learn from your mom, Albert? And what did you learn from your dad?
Well, from my mother, I learned to fear God and to love God and to be faithful. To recognize that God was always over our heads and that no matter what we did, we were accountable and answerable to Him. I learned the value of prayer. I learned the value of humility, all spiritual values. From my father, I learned hard work. From my father, I learned dedication to family, hard work, loyalty, and I learned humor. My father was a very funny man. My father was a kind of man who would go out of his way to, at any party, to find that person who nobody talked to and make him feel good, to go out of his way to help a neighbor, to go out of his way to shovel the snow for somebody else, to go out of his way to give some free building materials to somebody who needed them. And he did a lot of community service in that style. So my dad was about hard work, love of others. He was more quiet about his religion than my mother was and faith, but he did go to Mass and Communion every Sunday. And my mother, who was a daily communicant, really taught me the values, did a lot of talking to me, and more so than my dad. I think it was in the old days. You know, I was born in 1939, and I won't say my father was the strong, silent type, because he wasn't very silent. But he was a very strong man, had a strong character, but he let his actions speak. My mother would be philosophical. She would explain things. She would look at the rights and wrongs. She would connect it to Scripture. She liked to read her Bible. So it was a good combination for me.
You've been a truck driver. You've got a PhD in mechanical engineering from Michigan State. You've worked as a researcher for NASA, trying to solve the problem of how to land an astronaut on Mars. How have you done all of this?
You know, I look back and it's at the time it all seemed very natural. It's just like, that's what was in front of me. My brother was an engineer, and I had my Uncle Charles, who was the big successful businessman in our family. When I talked about what I wanted to do, he was one of those that I consulted and talked about being maybe a lawyer or a doctor or different things. All of my siblings, my brother and my two sisters, went to college, and some got advanced degrees. And I selected engineering. I got a lot of advice to become an engineer, and that it would be a good basic start for me to do. Once I got started with engineering at NJIT, New Jersey Institute of Technology, which when I went to it was called Newark College of Engineering, it just seemed natural to go and get more education after I got my bachelor's degree. And one of my professors said, well, you ought to go to the Midwest and see what it's like to be in a real campus, not in downtown Newark, where, you know, you're in the middle of the inner city, which was good for me, by the way. It got me to understand cities, and it's very much like Detroit. In fact, I was a professor at Wayne, assistant professor at Wayne, some time ago. So for me, it was a very natural progression at the time that seemed to be where my passions were. And one thing I learned from both my parents was to pursue my passions. So I had a passion for knowledge. I had a passion for engineering. I followed it. And it's that simple.
How did you ever get from NASA into the art business?
Well, that's an interesting story, in that in the 60s, we had here in Detroit, we probably remember in 1967, we had the riots. We had them in Newark. We had them in California. We also had a lot of turmoil in everything that was going on in our country, the Vietnam War. And the government decided that we were no longer going to be exploring deep space. So my work, if you like, of thinking about how we could get a man on Mars and being actively involved in that process with some wonderful people, Dr. Pai, who's now deceased, one of the great researchers of our era, who came from China, published over 300 articles and books I worked with on this, there was no more funding for it. And the funding that was developing was funding for offensive work with nuclear weapons on the ends of rockets, and that's the kind of direction I would have to head in to continue to do the research that I knew how to do, or was at least trying to do. And it's not where my heart took me. I just didn't want to do that, and I looked for something else and had to do something else, because I knew if I stayed in engineering, being with a PhD, you needed to do research. This is the way of life, and I liked it. I would wind up working on offensive weapons with nuclear weapons, and that would be where I would go, and my heart and my head were just not into it. So that was the main reason that I decided to make a switch from engineering and move into a totally unrelated field.
We're talking to Albert Scaglione. When we come back, we'll ask him how he used his engineering discipline to build the largest art dealer in the world. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're talking to Albert Scaglione, who earned a PhD in mechanical engineering from Michigan State University. Albert, how have you used this engineering acumen to build Park West Gallery to the largest art dealer in the world?
Oh, that's a great question, in that I don't know how I could have done it without it. I think it would have been literally impossible. Engineering is interesting. It's a method of thinking. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of organization. It's a way of compartmentalizing thought, abstract thought, theoretical thought, empirical knowledge, empirical meaning what you learn by doing, what you learn in the laboratory, and bringing them all together. And it was invaluable to me, because what I would do, first of all, I used two things. I used engineering and I used my teaching skills. Because what I found early on is that people just walking into a gallery were not very likely to buy enough art for even have me make a living. But I did find that if I did a group presentation, that good things would happen. One, I better be careful with what I say, because, which I would be anyway, but much more careful, organized, presenting material as I did as a college professor, because there were a number of people there. And it's like what Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people some of the time and all of the people all of the time, some of the time, whatever, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And you don't want to fool anybody any of the time. That would be my view. So by having group presentations in the form of selling models, in the form of auctions, good things would happen. I had to know my material. I had to explain to them what this art was all about. I had to be available before and after the auction for questions. And I had to have relationships with these folks. So the teaching skills were very important. Once I got a sales model that worked through the auctions, the engineering skills were equally important. Because now the ability, even my truck driving came to play, because I actually drove the truck that for the gallery for the first 5 or 8 years. From 1969 to 1975, thereabouts, if we did a sale in Cincinnati or wherever, I'm the truck driver. I mean, I didn't have that many employees, so I had to save money any place I could, and I didn't mind driving the truck, changing, putting a suit on, and selling the art. My clients knew it. They kind of liked it. They thought it, you know, they got the best possible deal, which they did, and still do. We do our best to do that. But the engineering was so important to be able to analyze costs, to be able to analyze it, for example, it became very natural for me to be able to read a financial statement. My work with our accountants became very natural for me. All things that I learned through my engineering discipline. So the use of computers. We, in the 70s already, we were involved in the computer world, and by the 80s, as an art company, we were very far ahead of the curve in that we could actually enter into a computer a series of descriptions or numbers that responded to art, and then kick that out as a ready-to-print catalog through computer work that we did. And I did it with very few, one programmer. And I would do the programming theories with the person, and I enjoyed that. So what happened was, using the things that I learned as a teacher and as an engineer, I was able to multitask and find I was passionate about many different aspects of the business, whether it was in this particular day building a computer model to do catalogs, or in that particular day trying to figure out the cost of how to get your trucks from point A to point B, or how to be the most efficient in picture framing. And the one strength that I think all of the education in engineering brought was a sense of being extremely accurate and diligent when it came to knowing the product. We do that today. The people who work for us today are put through rigorous training and testing continuously to be sure that the information that they put in front of the public is accurate. I use this example a lot. My sister Marie, who's a bit older than I am now, retired for many years, goes on a cruise. Now, I love my sister, and frankly, I give her stuff because she's my sister and I have a big art collection. And I warn her. I know she's very compulsive. Put your hands in your pockets, and you don't have to buy on these cruises. She can't do it. She buys. Our prices are good because she says, Albert, I'm so pleased with how these people emulate the model that I saw you have when you were young, of being, of bonding with people, of being accurate, of being friendly, of being clear. And the week I was on the cruise, she mentioned one of our people, Arthur Skeepers. She said, I loved Arthur. I put hugs on him because he always gave me the time. He always answered my questions accurately. When he didn't know the answer, he went and did research. He called home. He called Maury Shapiro. He got the answers correctly. So all of these things come together to create an environment where you can get your client to be able to make a good decision because you've given them accurate information. So all of this comes out of the engineering background, the teaching background, I think. Well, not all of it, but a lot of it.
You mentioned the cruise ships. It's 1994. You've got about 80 employees. And you convince somebody that you should let them auction art on a cruise ship. How did you do that?
I wish I could say that. They actually convinced me. I didn't want to do it at first, which is kind of odd, but I was very comfortable with what we were doing. We were making a good living. I was concerned that the cruise ship was not going to be a serious venue, and we'd been in business for 1969 to 94, 25 years. I didn't want to be in a strange world where maybe this is odd and it shouldn't be doing it. They kind of convinced me, and we did a couple of pilot programs and used the same business model, and it was extremely successful. And so I can't take credit for having convinced anybody. It's the other way around. We had executives from cruise lines come to us and said, we've seen your auctions in Miami. We've seen them in different parts of the country. We've had other people aboard. We'd like to give you the opportunity. And it was actually, I didn't realize how much they were actually offering. Because here they are knocking on my door, calling me up, and they actually flew in. Two executives flew in from Florida to visit with me to do this. And I was actually very pleasantly surprised at how successful it was right from the get-go.
And from that beginning, today, you supply the art for 85 ships, 8 different lines.
That's correct, yeah.
You are a consummate salesman. What makes a great salesman, Albert Scaglione?
Well, I think the first thing that makes a great salesman is truthfulness. I think number one is truthfulness. I think integrity and truthfulness. I think the liking people. I don't think you can be not a people person and be a great salesman. I don't think you can be the kind of person who, you know, you're sweet and wonderful in front of the client, then you go home and kick the cat and, you know, and throw things around. It doesn't work. You have to have a love of people. We say this in our training. If you're not the kind of person who can relate to others and listen to others, don't bother with this. I think that after that, it's knowledge. And, you know, if you have a great product, you can be a great salesman a lot easier than if you don't have a great product. You need a great product with a great price. So it's a great product with a great price, an ability to listen, an ability to be extremely accurate, an ability to learn. You're a purveyor of knowledge. You're a purveyor of information. In a way, you're a teacher. You're bringing knowledge to the public, whether that public. One of our problems is we do very well on the very high end with taking the time with each and every client. But I want to make sure that whether the price for something is $100,000 or $150,000 or $1,000 or $50, that we're equally accurate, and we do that. Now, you can imagine with a salesperson, it's a little harder to get their attention that way, but we're very, very much in the model because I'm still that way myself. When people come into the gallery, if I'm there, I'm going to shake everybody's hand. If I happen to be around, I'm not interested in what they buy or what they don't buy. I'm just interested in saying, hi, I'm Albert. You know, I'm the CEO of Parkwest Gallery. Thank you for being here today. Hope you have a nice day. Just that much. It really gets people happy and comfortable. And so the ability then to communicate this information in this set of parameters that I've given you, great product, great pricing, great knowledge, great teaching, a people person, all of the above are necessary to develop a great salesman.
Another thing a great salesman, Albert Scaglione, is a great listener. You are a great listener. When we come back, we'll ask Albert, how do you become a great listener? And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're talking to the CEO of Parkwest Gallery, Albert Scaglione. Albert, how do you become a great listener?
Well, you work at it. I mean, the first thing is work at it. Care about other people. And there's some scriptural reference that you can use. I'm a man who really likes to take pieces of scripture and try to get them to be part of my life. And a little piece of scripture says everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak. Think that one over. Quick to listen, slow to speak. I've always been quick to speak. And Jack, I've known you for a number of years now, and you said when we were off air how you called me a good listener. I said, really? And you said, well, you're a good talker, but you're even a better listener. I said, well, thank you. That's a real compliment. I've worked at it. My natural inclination is to be a presenter, to be a lecturer, to be a teacher, to be a giver of factual information. But on the other hand, if you don't listen to your students and find out where their holes are in their work, it doesn't work, does it? You've got to find out how to help people. So I think that you work at it. You just work at it. And you start to try to put yourself in the other person's place. One of the places where I'm very lucky is because I happen to be a talker, people want to say something to me, and they're anxious to. And when I finally shut down for a minute and let them talk, they flow. So it becomes easy for me to be a great listener because I happen to be a good, I shouldn't say good, I happen to be a talker. I happen to be a speaker, a teacher, is my basic background. So I think that the real issue is do the work at it, and don't think that your personality will cause you not to be a good listener. Whether you're an extrovert or an introvert or a talker or quiet, it's simply work. It's concern for the other person, and is listening to what God tells us. Everyone should be slow to speak and quick to listen. And also says slow to become angry. And that's a very important part. Anger has no real value in life for anyone. And if to the extent you can get rid of that, you'll be a much better listener. Focus on the other person.
In listening to you through the years, you talk about taking risks and losing millions in mistakes. You also say, quote, try and fail fast. What do you mean by that, Albert?
Well, you know, ideas come at you, and there's lots of good ideas that come at people all the time when they're in a business environment. You know, I'm speaking to young business people now or older business people now, and some of the time is we ruminate too long on those ideas. When you see good ideas, engage yourself with several others, the people who are going to execute the ideas. Test them quickly and flush them out. Fail fast, because what you're going to find, what I found, I don't know what you'll find, but what I have always found is nothing really ever works. You only get things to work by working at it, and through your failures are your successes. A trail of success is built on a trail of failure. So if you're going to have a big trail of success, you ought to have a huge amount of failure behind you. And if you've been in a business environment, the more money you make, well, in small ways, the more money you're going to lose as you're testing and modeling and figuring out.
The mistakes just have more zeros as you get bigger.
Exactly.
And even a blind squirrel finds an acorn once in a while.
That's for sure.
Okay. You state and you believe and you live, you run this firm, saying Jesus Christ runs Park West Galleries. In today's business world, nobody can be successful operating with those basics. How do you do it?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think you can be quite successful with that basic. And I use the name God runs the company in that, you know, what Christ was all about was simple. You love God and you love others. There are two commandments. That's it. You love God and you love others. Once you love God and you love others, I don't care what you call yourself in religion, doesn't make a difference. Doesn't make a difference. It's how you live your life. So in our case, in our business, I make it clear in every interview and every person who joins the firm and everybody I work with that the standards of the business are the standards established by the Lord, that I don't establish those standards. If I have any issue with any person ever, I want to resolve that issue through God, through Scripture. Often with myself, it's through prayer. And I have a wonderful group of people who work for our company. We're a very open employer. We have people of all races. We have people of all faiths. We have people of different sexual preferences. We're not prejudicial. Our job is not to judge anyone. Christ didn't. He told us that. You don't go out judging anybody. It's not for any of us on earth to determine who's going one way or who's going the other way or how long heaven or hell or how long it's going to take to get there. That's what God does. That's what he does. But what we need to do and what we do in our company, and we try very hard to do this, is to be faithful and to take the same values that you take into a church on Sunday when you're singing, praising God and singing hallelujah, and take those into the workplace every single time, all the time. And I maintain it's different than that, that what company can be successful. I think you can be successful for a while doing it the other way. But to be truly successful in life and to impact lives positively, I don't think you can be successful. I think you'll develop a culture that it's not the kind of culture I want to have around me. It's not what I would rather withdraw from the business world and frankly be in a monastery if that's what I had to live with. And that's not what God cut out for me. He wants me to do what I'm doing and I'm doing it. So I do think that they're very, very compatible. Let's talk about art. I mean, we sell things for a lot of money, $50,000, $100,000, more, hundreds of thousands, where it's a sheet of paper or a piece of canvas, you know, a few feet square. People, why are they doing that with us? Because our company is built on integrity. We've never sold a fake. We've sold millions of works of art. We've been really fortunate that way. Our diligence has paid off. We believe our pricing is terrific. When you sold as many things as we have, will somebody think something's too high or they got the super deal of the world? I guess so. But in the meantime, we're consistently diligent to give great value to the client and to have the integrity that we can have by the story I told you earlier. If my sister goes on a ship, And she knows, but she's a very bright woman. She's got degrees in accounting and business administration. She was a controller of the First National State Bank in New Jersey on the board of trustees, and just has a great career woman. And very, very smart, and does a lot of research. And when she comes back and checks all the prices, I just couldn't resist it. I mean, I'd seen this for that price and this price, and I just wanted that. And I know you probably would have given it to me, you know, for less or get, but no, I decided that I make my own money. And if I can please my own family like that, I guess we must be doing that right. So I think that that's the summation of it.
Albert Scaglione, you spend 2 to 3 hours every day reading the Bible and praying every morning. If there's a listener out there that says, I don't know how to pray, what do you tell that person?
Well, you know, the first thing I would tell a person is, as you wake up, I pray when I wake up. Connect to God immediately. The rest of the day will generate itself on that. So I do spend the first hour in prayer. I don't even get out of bed. I'm actually praying in bed. I actually pray while I stretch. I'm stretching my body. I'm almost 70 now, so I have to stretch out. It takes me 30 minutes to stretch. That's on autopilot, so God's not unhappy about that. And how do you pray? Well, you know, the Holy Spirit is really what takes over. And you pray by first of all, you have to be somehow involved scripturally, I think. I don't think you can be alone in this. Whether you're a Jew and you're only into the Old Testament, whether you're a Muslim and you're into the Quran only, or whether you're a Christian and you're into the Old and New Testament, you have to have some reference points about faithfulness to God and what God's all about. You can't just do it totally in a vacuum. So I would tend to think most of the listeners, the great majority of the listeners, are at that point. Once you're at that point, it's not hard to reach out to God. And, you know, Christ says to those Christians out there, and our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into the temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. That's enough. That's a great start. Father, protect me today. Father, help this person I know who has cancer. Let it be cured today. Father, let me help another person today. Father, let me reach out to someone today. Think of everything good that you can think of, everything that's true, everything that's noble, everything that's right, everything that's pure, everything that's lovely, everything that's admirable, everything that's excellent or praiseworthy, and throw them up to God. Throw them up to God and get yourself in that mindset. And try to stay in that mindset. If that means 3 minutes for you, do it for 3 minutes. It means 10 minutes, do it for 10 minutes. But do it. What a difference it'll make in your life.
Albert Scaglione. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Albert Scaglione, CEO of Parkwest Gallery, and his staff of 1,000-plus people represent the largest art dealership in the world. Albert, you've told me that God gives each of us tools, i.e. talents, and we're to use those to help other people. Expound on that, if you will.
Well, you know, it's the view of, I think, of anyone who is faithful and spiritual, independent of religion. All religions kind of converge at a point, and the convergence becomes the love of others, the love of others, the love of God and the love of others. And I think the convergence is also, we didn't invent ourselves. We didn't knit ourselves together in our mother's womb and pop out one day by our own willpower and our own invention. Our own life is a gift from God. All the blessings we get, whatever they are, financial blessings, material blessings, physical blessings, they're all gifts from God. To take them and hang on to them is, I remember at a service at a church where the person giving the service was Dave Wilson over at Kensington, and he had a funnel, and he took this funnel, and he said, a lot of us like to take this funnel, and God fills it up, and we put our hand over the bottom and kind of grab everything and eat it out for ourselves. We've got to take that funnel as God's lifting it up and just pour it all over the place. So it's and the other thing that you find, and my mother taught me this over and over again, and it's so true, it is much better to give than to receive. The gift of giving, the gift of giving yourself, the gift of giving love, there's nothing like it. So it's really very simple stuff.
3 years ago, your wife Mitzi and you started a foundation for abused girls. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, well, we started the Park West Foundation, and it actually has a bigger mission than just that, but a major part of its mission in that we want to let the foundation do work in the Lord's name all over the world and to help people in any way we can, and we have many things going on in that area, in Africa, in South America, in this country, working with people with AIDS. There's a lot of great people in the world who need help. And in terms of great people who help people with AIDS, John and Avril Thomas in South Africa, who have a staff of 150 and doing amazing things. Neil and Elise von Rensburg, Isaiah and Mercy Mafu. The list goes on. I could be giving you names now for the next 5 minutes of people that we're interactive with and trying to help in one way or another, whether it means financial help, whether it means spiritual help, prayer help, whether it means gathering people together for them, networking. I do a lot of networking, and that's a very important part. So the foundation, one of its main ministries is the foster care system in this city. My wife and I discovered the foster care system, in a sense, by meeting some young women who were in it at a place called Marlow House, run by Lutheran Child Family Services, who are good friends of ours. And we saw that when these girls got to be 18, and they were girls in a residential treatment center, they would be thrown into the system, and the odds were high, better than 50-50, that they would go into prostitution, drug addiction, all kinds of things that were just awful. Well, my wife was the one who really was the pioneer in this. She went down after there was a fundraiser at the gallery, and one of the young girls named Jewel did a drawing of the front of the gallery, which was beautiful. She said, "I'm going to go visit these girls." Well, she fell in love. She said, "They need love." This morning and last night, our last call before we went to bed was Olivia, one of our girls, and our first call in the morning was Olivia. Now, she doesn't need a lot of time. She needs a little time every day. She needs a few calls from my wife, more my wife than me. So what's that all about? We're there, and we're going to be doing more of this and letting the city know, because there's great people in the city who want to help as well. And the help, the bringing our city together about our foundation work for the foster care system says this: we have doctors who are donating their services. We have mentors. We have drivers. We're looking for an apartment building. We're looking for homes. We're looking for foster parents. My wife and I have taken this on personally. Our girls, and we've got about 39 of them, and a good number of them call us grandma and grandpa, because that's how they like to refer to us, because we're on a very personal level with them. We know their lives. The average girl who comes out of foster care has had 15 placements. Many of them have been born to a drug-addicted or crack-addicted parent or never had a parent, and they have great potential. In the 3 years we've had this mission, we haven't lost a one of them to the system. There's not a one of them that's in prostitution. There's not a one of them. Now, we've had some abortions, and we've had some kids born. That's going to be pretty common. And they're born at a young age, and none of them are wed. But it's something that I'll reach out to the community. You're going to hear more about this, that I think we can make an impact. There are 6,000 like this that are out there, and not just girls and boys. And we believe we can help, and the whole community can help, and we're after that.
If a listener wants to become involved, how can they reach you?
All you have to do is contact us at Park West Gallery, and we'll take the call. Our receptionist, Debbie Brakeman, and Alex, or one of our receptionists, will get the call passed along directly to my wife, believe it or not, and we'll work with you directly, and we'll put you in touch with a person who can help you, or tell us how you can help us, and we're looking forward to that.
What have these girls taught you, Albert Scaglione?
How love is so infectious, and how love works, that a little bit of love given to somebody just pays big dividends. And I'll tell you something else it's taught me. Most of them are African American. Someplace in most of their lives, they had a person, a grandmother, an uncle, an aunt who was faithful to God. And they've seen terrible things happen to them. And what we do is all of a sudden they see, because my wife and I, living, we go to church with them. We bring them to Tree of Life Bible Fellowship Church, which is mostly African-American people, and there are a number of white people there. It's over in Lawrence Institute of Technology's campus, and it works very well for our girls and for us. And what it's taught me is, don't give up. These problems are solvable. These kids are beautiful, and they can turn into wonderful leaders in our community, and they can become self-sufficient and not
be propagating what we look at now as the cycle of violence and drug addiction and prostitution that seems to be not breaking down. That's what they've taught us.
Amazing work, what you're doing. Amazing work. Last question tonight. What advice would you give to our young listeners?
Wow. I mean, first of all, I'm not the kind of person who likes to give a great deal of advice. I like to talk to each and every one of them and find out how I could help. That would be one thing. But I guess the advice would be to get with the Lord, to understand that we have the Almighty over our head. And whatever faith you were raised in, I would, if they've been atheists all their lives and were raised in atheism, it's hard for me to deal with that. But the love of God is going to accomplish everything for them. That's the first thing they have to do. Put your life in the hands of the Lord. And that's not easy for young people. That's not easy for young people. There's a lot of stimulation in all kinds of ways. Other advice I would give would be to not give up and to recognize there's help out there. There are people who will help them, that they need to reach out. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't, you know, and I'm talking to our city now. I'm talking to our problems now because, you know, I'm staying it out here. I've been in Detroit now since 1967. I came to Michigan in 1962 from Nutley, actually not Newark, but so close to Newark. And I'm a lifer. I mean, this is where my life is. This is where my heart is. And I'm here to help this community. I see great people in our community reaching out and helping each other. So don't give up. If you have any faith at all, get with the Lord and look for that help. You know, ask and you will receive. Seek and you will find. There is help out there. There are ways to do that.
Albert Scaglione, you are a true disciple. Thanks for coming tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jack.
Our guest next Sunday will be another business person who's turned his life over to God, Billy Downs, the president of 31 Mongolian Barbecues throughout the Midwest. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.